Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Hi, welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The term the Brill Building sound has been applied to a string of hit songs written and often recorded in a stretch of office buildings along Broadway between 49th and 53rd Street, although it wasn't really a specific sound. What most of the songs had in common was that they usually had bright and cheerfully catchy melodies that were influenced by rhythm and blues, Latin music, jazz, and gospel, and they dominated the pop charts in the late 1950s into the late 60s. Some of the more prominent artists who worked there included Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, Gene Pitney, Bobby Darin, Paul Simon, Neil Diamond, Neil Sedaka, Ellie Greenwich, Carole King and Jerry Goffin, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, and Rosemarie McCord. Arlene Corsano joins us now to talk about that important era in pop music history and about Rosemarie McCord, the subject of her book, Thought We Were Writing the Blues, But They Called It Rock and Roll. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been listening to you for quite a while, and I just never expected I'd be actually seeing you in person.
Well, today is a special day in another way. It's the first in a series of shows that are a result of listener suggestions. And a listener suggested that we look at your book, and we got really excited. Since there are a number of office buildings where the story takes place, how did it come to be called the Brill Building sound and the Brill Building and Brill Building pop?
Well, Carole King and most of those people, except for Rosemarie McCoy, were not in the Brill Building.
Yeah, they said the rent was too high.
Yes, 1650. They were in 1650. Rosemarie McCoy had an office in the Brill Building, especially in the 50s and 60s when she was really hitting it. But then she even moved to, she had an office in 1650, oh, up until 2000 and something, early 2000s, she finally gave it up.
Well, but we still associate Carole King and Jerry Goffin with the Brill Building sound, and their first number hit actually was already in the middle of this story, 1960, the Shirelles' Will You Love Me Tomorrow.
Yeah, and that was copied by a lot of people.
But did they all know each other? Hadn't Neil Sedaka written O Carole before Carole King teamed up with Jerry Goffin?
You know, I don't know. I know more about the 50s and 60s and Rose's music. Mm. You know, I know a bit about it because I grew up during the Carole King era. You know, I had Tapestry, of course, as just about anybody had. Rose did work out of the Brill Building for Alden Music, who Carole King and the whole group and Cynthia Weil, they worked in what Rose would call little cubby holes. So Rose never worked for a music publisher. Mm. But
she published her own music.
She published her own, or she went to different publishers. But Carole King and there were the six of them, three couples who worked there, Cynthia Weil, Carole King, and
Ellie Greenwich.
Ellie Greenwich. They were teams that worked in, if you see the Broadway show, in little cubby holes, like as Rose would call them, small offices, and they had hours, and they were told what to write. They would be given sometimes, oh, we need a song for this person, whereas the writers that of the 50s, and especially Rose and the other black writers of the 50s, they would, you know, meet all over. They would sometimes they'd write with their own teams, but they would go to places like the Brill Building and 1650 and start at the top floor and go to, publishers and say, do you like this song? And then they'd sing right there. And, sometimes there'd be piano there. Sometimes they'd sing a cappella. It was a little bit more like the Wild West. But 1650, where Carole King and the others were, that was more, set up. It was...
But this was a vertical approach. Actually, I had my own experience. My best friend in high school and I wrote some songs, and we went to the Brill Building, I think it was, where Herald Records was, well, one of those buildings. And somebody who is part of the Rosemary McCoy story, Fred Mendelson, and his partner Al Silver ran Herald Records. We just walked in and said, we have some songs. And they said, okay, sing them. And we sang them right there. I mean, you can't imagine this happening in the record business now. It was supposed to be recorded by the Turbans. They gave us a contract. We got impatient and we took the song back, stupidly.
Yes.
And
probably.
We went to Atlantic Records with it, and Jerry Wexler and Ahmet Erdogan listened to us. We just would walk in, and it was a different time. You just can't imagine something like that happening today.
Definitely. They used to meet in the Brill Building. On the bottom of the Brill Building, there were two restaurants, and one was called the Turf. It was the cheaper of the two. And Rose said you could go there and see Jackie Wilson and Dizzy Gillespie maybe at the bar, and the musicians would be there. So if you needed somebody to make a demo, you'd see them right there. Then there were other Alan, I forgot the other name. There were a few other Beefsteak Charlies, where they would congregate all during the day and sell songs right from there and written on a piece of paper or sometimes.
Well, these buildings were models of vertical integration. You could write a song, then, or you could make the rounds of publishers to try to sell it. Then you could go to another floor and get a lead sheet for $10. They get some copies made at the duplication office, the Xerox office, book an hour at a demo studio and hire some of the musicians and singers that hung around, and then cut a demo of your song and then take it around the building to the record companies, the publishers, the artists, managers, even the artists themselves. And if you made a deal, there were song pluggers there to take your song to the record stations and try to convince Alan Freed or Murray the K that they should play your record.
Yeah, thank goodness for Alan Freed, huh? Because I don't know if we'd hear some of these songs like Nappy Brown and Don't Be Angry. And
she wrote, now didn't Rosemary McCoy write Don't Be Angry by Nappy Brown?
Yeah, well, he had the song, but he had written something. It was not upbeat like that. In fact, it was Savoy Records. Who Herman Lubinsky?
Mm-hmm.
Newark, New Jersey. He had an office there, and Rose was asked to help him write this song, and so she made it up tempo, and that became, I think, number two on the rhythm and blues charts back then.
I had the record, the 45. Actually, it was the B side, but that's the one that the DJs like better. What led you to focus on Rosemary McCoy's story? Wasn't she something of an anomaly in the group because she was an African-American woman?
Yeah, and she was there. There were a lot of black writers that were big. Presley's first album, half of the writers were black writers.
Well, most of them were covers of other people's songs, weren't they?
No, his first
Lieber
album.
Before Lieber and Stoller took him over?
No, this is before Lieber and Stoller. Maybe they weren't on the first album. I don't think Lieber and Stoller had a song on the first album. Little Richard had a song on the first album. Number of other, but half of them, I don't remember who the other half were, but I remember the half of them were black writers. And because they were writing rhythm and blues, which really was rock and roll, they just called it rock and roll because rhythm and blues meant it was black music, and black music wasn't played on major radio stations until like Alan Freed came by. So she wrote it with him. And her apartment, they sent. She had at the time an apartment in the Bronx, and Nappy Brown was sent there, and they sat down. He played piano a little bit, and they worked on it, and that's how the song. But I think Fred Mendelson has his name on it because back then, this was one of her first hits. Other people were putting names on their songs. If you wanted it recorded, you better give credit. And then she didn't have to do that anymore when she got to be big.
Even Natural Woman, I think it was not. There's a writer credit for Jerry Wexler because, or Ahmet Erdogan or somebody, because he came up with the name, but he didn't write the song. And then the DJs would also take writer's credit sincerely. by the moon glows. Well, Alan Freed is given writer's credit. All he did was agree to play the record and make it into a hit.
Yeah, and poor Alan Freed, he suffered the most because Dick Clark was doing a lot of that too, but he didn't get caught. He seemed
Sorry for Alan Freed. He was a corrupt person. Well, and maybe. He wound up suffering in the end because the mob got him a job down in Florida after he was fired from New York Radio, and they said, stop taking payola. And he couldn't stop, and they kind of broke his legs, and I think he died in the water or something
like
that.
No, he died in California.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he died in California. But Dick Clark was doing a lot of that, too. You know, he had people on contract that he would have on his show, but he seemed to get away with it.
Segregation was the law of in the South, but it was kind of de facto situation in the North. What about in this community of songwriters? Was Rosemary considered a member of the Brill Building community?
Yeah, I think she did very well with everybody. She had a lot of. She mostly wrote with Charlie Singleton. Well, first she wrote by herself, and she had, in fact, things out by Louis Jordan that she had written by herself, but. Other people, like the arranger, took credit, and she didn't know the business either. She wrote Big Maybelle's first hit. In fact, she even is talking on it because the guy who was supposed to do it couldn't do it. And so she wrote by herself, but then she got together with Charlie Singleton, and he knew the business a little bit. He was a shrewd guy. He had been in the music business down in Florida. He came up here, and she learned a lot from him. And he taught her not to give credit anymore. Like, you don't have to do that anymore, he said. You know, you do that when you really want something done. But people were going after her and Charlie. And so there was a group of them. They would hang out. They'd go to the track. They'd write, you know, all over the place. And they'd help each other out. They weren't, you know, all partners with each other. But... It was a close group, but she didn't have any trouble with anybody, it seemed. And it's kind of funny because, you know, you figure she had to have some kind of trouble. It was still the North. It was still the 50s. But she wouldn't talk about it. She said, no, I just did what I did, and it worked out. And other people who knew her back then said, yeah, she seemed to just walk right through it. Well, she was very pretty. She was very funny. She was very, very kind, so she was just very likable.
You quote Maxine Brown saying, she knew how to hang in there with the big boys. Everyone was scrapping to get there, but it was always men. Women didn't have a place, so she made a place for herself. But there were a number of women, but they were all co-writers with men.
Not in the 50s. There were very few. There was a country writer... Cindy Walker, she had a lot of songs. She was, you know, wrote as much, if not more than Rose, or she had more hits, maybe didn't write as many. But
well, Rose wrote 800 songs, but she didn't have that many hits.
Yeah, but a lot of her hits were rhythm and blues hits. So most of them were rhythm and blues hits, but she had a lot of big people from like Peggy Lee, Brenda Lee, Ruth Brown, Nappy Brown, James Brown, Aretha Franklin. I mean, she had big people doing them right through the 70s. She even had gospel greats doing. Shirley Caesar did her song. So she had a lot of people doing it. One disc jockey called her the B-side queen. Mm-hmm. So she had a lot on albums, a lot. She had probably had more major names doing it. It's not that she wrote a song and they became a hit because of that, but like very established artists would do her songs.
I wrote out a list. It's maybe too long to say all the names of people who recorded her songs. Nat King Cole, Big Maybelle, Little Willie John, Ruth Brown, Eartha Kitt, Aretha Franklin, Eddie Arnold, country singer, Little Esther, The Clovers, Jimmy Scott, Sarah Vaughan, Pearl Bailey, Shirley Caesar, Les Paul and Mary Ford, Patti Page, Debbie Reynolds, Dinah Washington, Del Shannon, Solomon Burke, Al Hibbler, Jimmy Rushing, Bette Midler, Billy Eckstein, Ella Mae Morse, Dizzy Gillespie recorded one of her songs. Then Brooke Benton, Ivory Joe Hunter, Jimmy Rushing, Peggy Lee, Joe Stafford, Georgia Gibbs, Linda Hopkins, The Platters, Dakota Staton, The Harp Tones, Moms Mobley, Etta James, Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, and as you said earlier, Elvis Presley.
Elvis did too, and he doesn't have his name on either song.
Should we listen to a little bit of what she wrote for Elvis?
Oh, sure.
Okay, well, first of all, let me tell everyone that my guest is Arlene Cressano, and we're talking about the Brill Building and that whole community, and also about her book, Thought We Were Writing the Blues, But They Called It Rock and Roll.
I don't want my heart to be broken, but it's the only one I've got. So darling, please be careful, even though I care a lot. Darling, please don't break my heart, I beg of you. I don't want no tears to fall, you know I hate to cry. Well, that's what's bound to happen if you ever say goodbye. Darling, please don't say goodbye, I beg of you. Hold my hand and promise that you'll always love me too. Make me know you love me same way I love you, little girl. You got me at your mercy, but I'm in love with you. So please don't take advantage, cause you know my love is true. Darling, please, please love me too, I beg of you.
My guest on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM is Arlene Cressano, who's written about the Brill Building community, and one of the composers in that community, Rosemarie McCoy. Her book, Thought We Were Writing the Blues, But They Called It Rock and Roll. Now, Rosemarie began as a singer. How did she come to compose, produce, and even publish so many songs?
Well, she never wanted to be a songwriter. She wanted to be a singer. She saw singers down in Arkansas at her high school. Big bands would come through and rehearse there and give a show for the students. And she was just thrilled because she was a very bright woman. She had a scholarship to Philander Smith.
But wait, she grew up in the Mississippi Delta. And that was the home of, some people say that's where the blues really began, although they didn't. But that's where most of the greatest blues formers came from. Did she hear any of them when she was growing up?
Oh, plenty. Not when she grew up in Oneida, Arkansas, which is a very farming community. But she couldn't go to high school. There was no high school for black students there back then. So she went to Helena, Arkansas. And Helena had a high school, a pretty nice high school for students, and she had grandparents that lived there, so she lived with them. And Helena was known as the capital of the Mississippi.
Weren't the blues considered the devil's music?
And
family was religious, and they didn't want her to even hear the blues.
Well, she didn't hear it when back home, you know, because she lived in a shack and 40 acres that they were renting, and she didn't hear it there. But except she said once she heard a field hand that used to come by and work for some people, she used to hear him singing the blues, and she thought it was so great. But she would go see her grandparents sometimes in Helena, and when she lived there through her high school years, she heard them in a juke joint called the Hole in the Wall Club. And there were Robert Johnson, he lived there for a while, and a lot of big bluesmen. Lived in Helena, or they came through, they traveled through because there were so many clubs to play there too. And so when she heard that, she wanted to be a singer. She just thought it was so glamorous. They got to dress up because she never had anything new, and she knew she was good because she would sing in churches, and she sang in her high school shows, and she loved performing. So she came up here to make her money and get her parents out of poverty by becoming a big singer. So she came to, she knew it was New York or Chicago. She chose New York. And
but her parents wanted her, or her mother wanted her to become a school teacher.
Yeah, well, she snuck out. She said, I have to get a job for the summer, make some money. And she, one of the neighbors in Helena, her grandmother's neighbor, found her a job. And she says, oh, I'll go there and I'll come back. And then she kind of finagled a little bit. And they were never happy. She even had a club one time, and her father said, well, you got to get me out of here with these hellions. I don't want to be with these hellions. But they still loved their daughter, of course.
So she came to the New York area, lived in Harlem for a while, lived in New Jersey, was all around, although she died.
In Illinois.
In Illinois.
Yeah,
She worked in some of the leading clubs here and in Detroit and Cincinnati and Toronto for about 10 years before she made her first records in 1952.
Well, she did have one in 46, one that came out, and it was on Queen Records. It was King Records, had Queen Records for a while. And it was the Jubilaires. Mm-hmm. And she quit them. She said, they're not going anywhere. It was a singing, you know, she was singing with them, but she had written a song, and they did it after she left. And so it got recorded, but it really didn't go anywhere because they wanted something, and the guy who, the head of the Jubilaires said no, and so they didn't push it. They didn't record it again. It was a big saxophone player wanted to do it. In fact, he played it one time on a Harlem stage and had her come and sit up on the stage. And she says, and I just cried and cried.
Well, King is an interesting label because it started as a country label. And then they developed an R&B subsidiary, Queen, and then they merged the two. And most people remember King these days as one of the great R&B labels.
Yeah,
And also jazz. Yeah,
Little Willie John.
So she made her first records, Cheating Blues and Georgie Boy Blues. Did she think of herself as a blues performer?
That's what they wanted. She would perform, jazz, blues, and that was basically what people wanted in the clubs.
Did she write those songs?
Oh yeah, she wrote Georgie Boy Blues and she wrote Cheating Blues,
mm-hmm.
and that was put out on a very small label. In fact, it lasted less than a year, but it gave birth to one of the longest songwriting careers ever because her last songs came out in 2013, and in 1946 she had that one song. That the Jubilaires did, but she quit because she got $8, and she says, "Oh shoot, I thought you made a lot of money," so she quit writing.
Well, after those first recordings were released, she was asked to write songs for other performers.
Yeah,
and that's what led her to write for Big Maybelle.
Yeah, Big Maybelle was the first one. I think the arranger or the producer at Wheeler Records, the one that the small record company that she made her record on. He got her in touch, and she said, I'll give you credit. So she knew that was going on. She says, I'll give you credit if you get me something else. And he did. He got her the Big Maybelle.
Gabin Blues. She wrote it with Leroy Kirkland. How did she meet Leroy Kirkland?
Well, she wrote it by herself. Leroy Kirkland is the one who got her the deal. So she gave him credit. Her first song.
This whole business about who gets credit is really murky, isn't it?
Yeah. It happened for a long time, though. You see nobody else getting credit for her records except Charlie Singleton, because he made sure that they didn't give credit to anybody else.
People forget Big Maybelle, who was a wonderful singer, and she... she had a huge hit with Candy, I remember. But this was her first big hit. It reached number 3 on the Billboard R&B charts.
Yeah.
Gabin Blues. But we don't hear it anymore. In fact, a lot of the songs have totally disappeared. Do you know why?
Well, I guess a lot of probably depends on the music publisher. You know, if you were with one publisher and... you know, and they have a lot of your songs, they're probably going to push you to get you on the radio. I know they say there's no more payola, but there's kind of sort of around the barn kind of payola. So they will push to get your songs out there. They'll push to get you acknowledged for the Songwriters Hall of Fame. And a lot of them were just played on small radio stations anyway. Big Maybell never probably it was ever played on a major radio station like CBS or NBC.
I loved her.
Yeah, she was great. And people still, to this day, that we did an hour-long documentary that was distributed by PRI. And after it came out, people were writing in that, oh, my God, you got to do something about this, that she's, you know, such a... a woman with so many songs that how come we don't know about her? But and a lot of people mentioned that they remember hearing Gabin Blues when they were kids, and they still laugh. And now their grandchildren, they play it for their grandchildren.
Are there any songs that most of our listeners would remember? I mean, some would probably remember "Don't Be Angry," which she at least. She co-wrote with Fred Mendelson, or at least he gets credit for it, the guy who created Herald Records later. That was Nappy Brown's first, that was a big hit for Nappy Brown. And she must have made some very nice royalties from that, because it was a hit, and then it was covered by the Crew Cuts of Shaboom fame.
Yeah, and a lot of people covered it. Yeah.
It was not uncommon at that time that an R&B record, which might have still been called race music, would then be covered by Pat Boone or.
He made a career out of it practically.
Yeah, although he changed the lyrics. I remember "Crazy Little Mama." The lyric was, "If you got a little mama and you want to keep her neat, keep your mama off my street." And Pat Boone changed that. "If you got a little mama and you want to get along, teach your mama right from wrong."
Oh, that was Pat Boone.
That was Pat Boone.
You know, and that's what I was hearing when I was very young. I didn't hear a lot of these songs, but Mercury did a lot of that, and they would do it within months of as soon as they saw something going to the top, like "Don't Be Angry," they would get the Crew Cuts or somebody else.
Or Georgia Gibbs.
Georgia Gibbs did a lot too, an awful lot. In fact, Georgia Gibbs covered Laverne Baker's. Tweedledee and other songs too. And there was a story that Laverne Baker, when she was going to Australia on a plane, used to be able to go to a kiosk and you could get like $10,000 of insurance if the plane goes down for maybe $2 or something. I remember that. And she took a policy out on her own life and mailed it to Georgia Gibbs and said, "This is in case anything happens to me, your career is over. So you'll
funny.
Need this."
Yeah. She died in her home in Champaign, Illinois.
No, that wasn't. She was at a niece's home. Her niece took her out there. Yeah.
But she was 92. This was January 2015, and she'd received a lot of honors before she died, but she's never been inducted to the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Why do you think that is?
Well, I kind of know why. I think I know why. I'm an executive of a large. Publishing company. I don't want to name anybody because this is what he said, that they were trying to get one of their songwriters in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the message came back, "Well, how much are you going to give us?" So there's nobody to give money for Rose to get in there. And, I had petition sent, you know, saying, you know, why isn't she there? She's got this many hits. Oh, and I even spoke to somebody, and they gave me this story about, well, you have to belong to the Songwriters Hall of Fame, then you can put her up, and, you know, as if it was out of their hands, which I know it's not. So I think she doesn't have anybody really pushing for her. I tried to push. I did it twice. I had the coalitions of 100 black women from New York and New Jersey sign petitions and send it and say, this is kind of embarrassing because you've got people there who have not written much at all or have written their own songs or co-wrote them and maybe didn't even write them. And not even just Rose, and even before Rose is Charlie Singleton. I don't know if you know that name. He had two songs in BMI's Top 100 Songs of the Century, too. Now, there's only, I don't know who else, maybe there were two other writers who had two, you know, more than one. That's 100 songs of 100 years, and he has two, Strangers in the Night and, I forgot the other one. And he wrote Lady and a lot of big songs that, you know, plus with Rose, and he never got in. But he also, like Rose, they didn't like signing with a publisher. They didn't want to be on staff. She said, that was like prison to me. It was like they owned you. And she did it. I remember once she did it because she needed money. She had taken out a second mortgage on her house, and she and her husband went into a club, and it was going under, and she was afraid of losing the house. So she went on staff and didn't last a year because she came back from late for lunch, and she yelled at the guy, like the owner. She said, "You don't write no songs by no clock." And he yelled at her, and she was yelling at him, and he fired her. So she got the advance. She said so she was okay, but you know you need somebody plugging for you that has some pull or some money, or you know I'd like to embarrass them, but of course I would.
There are all sorts of class structures in the music business at that time. You mentioned BMI. BMI was created because ASCAP really wasn't representing songwriters like Rose very well. The new rock and roll composers all went to BMI because it was an easier way to get your royalties.
Well, at first they weren't even accepting them. If you wrote blues or... I don't know, I guess blues mostly. If you thought blues or rock and roll, they weren't even accepting them as into ASCAP. It was probably the late, I don't know when they started accepting them, the early 50s. They would take them in. So that's why. And then sometimes Rose would write with an ASCAP writer, but she was forbidden to. If you belonged to ASCAP, you had to only be ASCAP, and you couldn't even write with somebody else. And I think BMI had the same, BMI had the same thing for a while because they were such adversaries.
The complaint of people, the rock and roll songwriters, was that they could have a huge hit, but because of the way ASCAP was structured, a lot of their royalties would wind up going to Irving Berlin or George Gershwin or some of the other big stars of ASCAP, and they didn't get complete royalties that they had earned.
Right, that was there too, and I think that was from something from before. I know Rose couldn't even join when she first went in, but even after that, and I don't know what years, but it was around those years, and before that, they had a different structure, a scale. So if you were a big writer, you got more. You got a bigger percentage. And if you were new and you didn't, you would get less money depending on who you were. So Billy Rose would get, you know, a lot. And
well, how well did Rosemarie do? Did she at the end, since she had written 800 songs and there were a lot of records out there, some of them hits? Did she have a comfortable living at the end?
Well, you know, she's got really over 800 some. I found 360 singers who have done her songs. And people like Little Jimmy Scott did 8. Ruth Brown did 11.
Yeah, and they weren't all R&B singers. As I said, there were country singers and there were jazz musicians. Jimmy Scott, Sarah Vaughan, Dinah Washington.
Yeah, so that was 360 artists. It's way over 360 songs she has out. But she was cheated a lot, and she didn't like to. There was one publishing company that she said lawyers were after me all the time to sue him, because I had a lot of songs. She gave the publishing, not her, you know, her writing. She still had the writing credit, but you needed somebody. She was publishing some of her own songs, but it's kind of hard to sell your own song, so you need a publishing company to get out there and push for you. And a lot of them were cheating her. And this one, they wanted her to, you know, to take him to court. And she says, oh, I really didn't want that reputation as somebody who would sue. But that's what she really needed. And I went to her her lawyer, who was Bill Krasilowski. And he was very well known. He wrote the book, This Music Business. And about 10 years ago, it was in its 11th publication. So that's he was the guy to go to. And that the publishers, even one of them, told me we were afraid of him, because even if we thought he was wrong, he was going to have us in court forever. And he said, but you know what she would do? She'd come in here with like a bag full of things and say, Bill, like, they're cheating me. And she was not good at the business end. So she got cheated a lot. So she made a lot, and at one point she had a yacht. And by 1955, she had a house in New Jersey, a new, brand new house, a yacht, and a green Cadillac.
Oh.
And so, you know, that she did very well within like 3 years, but everything was from advances. She did not, the royalties she wasn't getting, except for, she always said, Elvis Presley music paid the best. They didn't cheat, but a lot of them just cheated.
I'm speaking with Arlene Corsano, whose book, Thought We Were Writing the Blues, but they called it Rock and Roll, is a biography of Rosemary McCoy, but also looks at the whole Brill Building culture. Rosemarie co-wrote a song, or at least is credited with co-writing a song with Sylvia McKinney that was her most successful song of the 60s, and also really brought a certain husband and wife team of the time to some prominence. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Darling.
Yes, Tina.
You're starting to get next to me.
Honey, that was my plan from the very beginning.
Darling.
Uh-huh.
I never thought that this could be.
What do you mean?
Oh, yeah. Your lips set my soul on fire. You fulfill my one desire. Oh, darling.
Yes, yes.
It's gonna work out fine.
It's gonna work out fine.
I wanna tell you something, I've been to see the preacher man.
A preacher man? You must be losing your mind.
I started
what?
Started making wedding plans.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. If your love is half a truth, as a love you, oh darling.
Yes, yes.
I think it's gonna work out fine.
It's gonna work out fine.
I keep on telling you,
I think it's gonna work out fine.
I can feel it's gonna,
feel it's gonna work out.
I keep on telling you,
I know it's gonna work out fine.
I'm so glad that you're mine, oh my.
Remember what?
They used to call you Dapper Dan.
Yes, those were the good old days.
The thriller.
The killer, honey.
The ever-ready loving man.
That's me.
Oh, yeah. A whole lot of girls used to be your speed.
It's obvious why It's Gonna Work Out Fine became a hit. What a great record. But, it was Ike and Tina's first top 20 pop single, 1961. They got their first Grammy nomination. But you just told me that wasn't Ike. They
nope.
On the record.
Mickey Baker. Mickey Guitar Baker, as they called him.
Yeah.
Ike couldn't get it right.
Who later did records with Sylvia, Mickey and Sylvia. And they had a bunch of hit records as well.
In fact, their hit was before that, because Rose had showed that song around, and nobody seemed to like it, so she put it in a box, and Mickey came over to teach Rose a guitar song, something she wanted to learn on guitar. And so, because Sylvia lived not too far from Rose. And while Sylvia was looking through this box of songs, she says, here's a great song. And Rose said, no, nobody likes that. So she said, she told her, come tomorrow. Ike and Tina Turner were at the Apollo, their first hit they were singing. And so Rose went, and they were in the dressing room, and she's talking to Ike Turner, and he calls in Tina, and he says, sing the song for that girl. Sing the song for that girl, meaning Rose. And Rose said she sang it without any accompaniment, just right there, stood up and sang, and like her life depended on it. Probably did, knowing what happened. And then Ike says, you can go now. And she leaves, and Sylvia says, okay, we're going to go now. After the show, we're going to go to Sue Records and record this. And Rose says, oh, I got something to do. She said, I can't go. She said, I really didn't have anything to do, but I thought she was crazy. Because they had taken it already to... Oh, that was... They didn't go right away. They took it to Hugo and Luigi, the big RCA producers, and they didn't like it. They didn't say anything. Rose said they knew me well, so they didn't say anything. But when they walked out, Ike said, see, they didn't like it either. And so, because apparently, Mickey didn't like it. So it was, but they couldn't get it, that it was a good song. But Sylvia saw it. If it wasn't for Sylvia Robinson, that song might still be in a box somewhere.
She later became a major record executive.
What was her husband, Joe Robinson? Yeah.
But on this record, Ike couldn't get the talking part right, so Mickey Baker did the talking part. Everybody assumed that it was Ike.
Right, yeah.
And I'm assuming that Ike learned it finally, so that when they did live performances, he was the one who did it. They didn't.
Right, he finally did, but he couldn't do it like right away. So I guess it was like the next day they went, not that night.
Why did Rosemarie turn down several opportunities to join major record labels like Motown, Stax, Atlantic?
Well, she always said it was like they owned you. It was like you were in prison, because they would tell you when to write it, you know, come in this time, and when to write it, and you've got to write this song for that one, and no, we want a little bit more this. And she just wrote songs that you know, she and Charlie Singleton, because she wrote with him a lot of her first hits with Charlie Singleton for like almost 5 years, a little bit more than 5 years. And she just wanted to be free. And I think she liked the whole scene of, they would meet early in the morning at Beefsteak Charlie's, and she said we'd order a glass of wine and sip it all morning to like pay for our drinks. And the bartender would take their calls. She said it was like our office in the afternoon. The publishers would come. And sometimes she said we'd sing songs right there in the booth, and they'd buy maybe three or four songs. So they were very fast writers. And I think she liked that, you know, moving around, not sitting in an office all day. And she was a farm girl. You know, she was a farm girl. She was a singer. She was, you know, she was very energetic when she would sing. She would even when she traveled, she would think it was wasting time just to sleep all day and next to do the show at night. So she'd go out and iron shirts, because she knew how to iron shirts. So I think it was just too confining for her.
And how did you meet her? Did you just present yourself to her at some point?
No. I had written a show for Maxine Brown and two other friends called While Women Don't Have the Blues. It was not my music. I just write the in-between stuff. And we were working on that. Maxine had just moved to an apartment in Harlem, and she was having a party. So she invited me, and she invited my cousin, who she knew, who had helped out at shows. And so we're there, and I'm sharing numbers with somebody. And neither one of us had a pen. So, you know, I asked my cousin, and Rose said, taps me on the shoulder, because she didn't have one either. She says, I have a pen. She says, but I need it because I hit my neighbor's car the way over, just backing out.
This is with her Cadillac?
Yeah, with a Cadillac, which had this down. Beautiful, beautiful car, but, you know, because it's maybe a fifth or sixth can. But she, you know, I said, the next day I called up Maxine, and I said, oh, my cousin said she lives close to us. I said, she hit the neighbor's car. She got lost getting here, and she used to live in Harlem. I said, next time we have something, I'll pick her up. She doesn't live far from me. So she said, you know, you should write. I was writing articles for local newspapers. I had retired from teaching by then. And And so she said, you should write an article about her. So I did, and I learned just about a tenth of what she did, and I was blown away because she kissed Jackie Wilson. She wrote a song for him, A Kiss of Thrilling Goodbye, in fact. So she was very, she was just fun to be around. But one of the writers used to call her the effervescent one. And that's exactly what she was. So we had a lot of fun. She had a lot of stories. And so I wrote that article, and she started telling people, Arlene's going to make me famous. Mm-hmm. And so one day she said that to somebody. I said, Rose, you have to stop saying that. I said, I don't know how. I'm not this or that. She says, and she's going to write a book. I said, I can't write a book. And
you wound up writing
the
book.
She said it, 10 years later, I guess it took me. Because I was interviewing her for other writers. There was one that she knew who was always interviewing her for his books or things. And I said, why aren't you writing about Rose? He said, too difficult. And I didn't understand why until I started to interview her. And she didn't want to be, let's go have lunch. No, let's do this. No, we'll talk tomorrow. So you needed a lot of time. I was retired. I had the time. And she was my pal. So
I want to go back to the whole business of the Brill Building. Before that area took over, we had Tin Pan Alley, which is still the name that we apply to the sort of thing that happened in the Brill Building area. Did they move uptown to this place, 49th, in the early 50s? Which is, by the way, where Stephen Colbert's show is now broadcast. Also, it was where Birdland was, where Colony Music was. Did they move there because it was the theater district, and they felt that they might get more attention there?
Maybe some did, but I did read about the Brill Building, which was built 1931, and it was the Depression, so the guys who had it lost it. And
it wasn't the Brills, actually.
It could have been the Left Court Building, which wouldn't sound so good. But the Brill brothers, who had a clothing store on the bottom, they acquired it. And it was I've read a while ago, I haven't seen this again, it was bigger offices. They expected some big companies to come in there. And when they couldn't rent it, they chopped up some of those offices, which was perfect for a song plugger and songwriters who what do they need, a room and two at the most.
And people started moving in the 30s and 40s, but it really reached its heyday when the music business changed after World War II, when the big bands shrank, swing lost its hold on pop music, and jazz got into smaller groups. And then you had the blues singers. You had doo-wop came into pop music with a lot of amateur songwriters. The Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers wrote their own songs. And then suddenly you have this thing happening with hit records like Will You Love Me Tomorrow, The Locomotion, Leader of the Pack, One Fine Day, You've Lost That Love and Feeling on Broadway. Mm. These are professional songs. And that became very big. And then the whole thing dies again. Is it because of the British invasion?
Well, that hurt an awful lot because they started writing their own songs. At first the Beatles were doing covers over in England, but when they learned that they could write their own songs and they were selling anyway, it was more the beat and whatever was selling. It wasn't exactly a song that they needed from a songwriter, and it was more kid stuff too. They call the Brill Building sound, which was really pop. And more like the bubblegum music, more for kids, more teen music that you got out of 1650. They were still going, but a lot of people writing their own songs. The Bob Dylan came by, and there was that group of people, and there was.
So you got the singer-songwriter instead of relying on people like Hal David and Burt Bacharach to give you a song like raindrops keep falling on my head. You have singer-songwriters who become famous not only for their performances, but for the songs that they've written. Bob Dylan, obviously the most famous, but there was a whole bunch of them.
But the, and then there was also the production became more important than the song. You know, in the 50s and the 40s, you know, especially the 50s, like Atlantic Records, they used to record their first songs, like with Ruth Brown. Rose said they'd move their desks back. And they weren't in the Brill Building in Atlanta. They were one of the smaller buildings. And they'd move their desks back, and they would have Ruth singing and all the musicians. They didn't even have screens in between them, she says, so there was bleed. But the songs were selling anyway. Then the production came, the wall of sound.
But I want to add something, because when I, in my days when I used to hang around the Brill Building, I was told by a member of one of the doo-wop groups that they liked to record in the stairwell because it gave them a perfect natural echo. You can't imagine anybody doing that today.
No, now they have every. Now they could make me. I mean, I have trouble singing "Happy Birthday," but they have things that they could put me right in key, uh-huh. even. And in the 60s, I think that's when your production became. You didn't need the greatest singer. You needed.
Suddenly, there were strings, hype. And there were all sorts of other things happening on the records. When you think back to the old days, with Bessie Smith recorded some of the greatest recordings ever with Louis Armstrong and Fred Longstreet, and that was enough. A cornet and a guy on some kind of organ type instrument, harmonium, right. I think it was. And that was it. And you get classic records as a result. Right. And now you needed all of this big production. And then Bob Dylan, I guess, simplifies it again. The Beatles simplify it again.
And you need tracks, too, because they had to do it all. You'll hear a lot of mistakes on records that Warren, there's an Ivory Joe Hunter record. I remember it always grabs me because, you know, he's saying look like instead of looks like. Mm-hmm. And they didn't even do it over again. And they couldn't cut things in. Like Sarah Vaughan was doing one of, she did like six of Rose's songs, and one song she couldn't get right. Lenny Welch did it. She said he had no trouble, but Sarah couldn't get it. She said, if you listen carefully, you can see how they pieced it together because she couldn't do it through. And this is the great Sarah Vaughan. So this is what they do. It's going to cost this much money to keep her here another day, and maybe she'll never get it. So they didn't do that back then. Well, they couldn't do it back then.
Well, you had tape editing, which really helped to create more sophisticated recordings. Of course, now everything is done digitally. So, but then again, forgive me for saying this, all you people who love what's being recorded today, but you don't have melodies anymore. I don't know what happened. When you think of the Brill Building period, incredible melodies. You really, those songs stuck in your head. And I'm amused by the fact that right now they're not writing jingles for commercials anymore. They're going back to that period and they're putting songs from that era on commercials.
Yeah, it's probably, maybe it's cheaper for the, right. I don't know. I don't know how much they have to pay for that, but it's probably, maybe it's cheaper. Rose mm-hmm. wrote some jingles too for Coca-Cola. With Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and the Brooklyn Bridge. And she went into commercial writing because she said it got harder and harder. And she said, and we used to just walk into offices, you know, like Jackie Wilson might have his office. I think I have something for you, but you can't do that anymore. She said, you can't go, you know, you can't see people, you know, they're not so as accessible. In fact, she was on a plane with Elvis Presley once and she never went up to say hello. Because for as
even though she had written one of his hits originally.
She wrote two songs for him. She said, I had my card, and she was, I think the plane was in Memphis or Nashville, and she said, I had my card and everything. She said, but he looked so shy, like he was in first class, and nobody even recognized him. He had his hair over his ear, and then when he left, somebody said, there goes the king, and the whole airplane was upset. She says, I could have gone. I said, oh, I'll get him another time. She said, he could have given me a Cadillac, she said, because he would do that to give people Cadillacs that he didn't know, and just to be nice. But she might have gotten more songs with him. She couldn't get more because the top floor was the Aberbacks. I'm trying to think of their it's a big publishing company that had the top floor in the Bill Building, the 11th floor, and they had Elvis. They were co-publishers with Elvis Presley Music, and so they had staff writers, and so they would give all their songs to their staff writers. I have a book of writers for the King, and there's some women there, but they wrote 10 songs, but you don't know any of them. Because they would say the movies, and the movies, that a lot of their songs weren't so great.
But the staff writers would be told, we need a song for Elvis that's about wooing a young woman or something like that, and they would write a song.
Well, they'd give them the actual script and tell them they had to do that. So it was a lot of sitting and reading the script and thinking, and it probably took a lot of time, and she just wasn't interested in that anyway. But
Arlene, it's been a lot of fun talking with you. If people want to get a copy of Thought We Were Writing the Blues, but they called it Rock and Roll, how can they access it?
Amazon. Or you could go to, because Amazon has the digital version and the hard copy. You could go to RosemarieMcCoyMusic.com. Uh-huh. Which will probably only take you to Amazon or something like CreateSpace. But there should be some more information about Rose there in the future.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Arlene Corsano, to Reggie Johnson, who's at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Located at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.